we talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com. Talk to Patrick now, 888-663-6386, or email Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning. It is 25 before the hour. Nora Gadgadis. She is the author of Primal Body, Primal Mind. Before we get back into what we were talking about, you said that you've been at this nutritional science, Nora, for 25 years. Give us an idea of some of the things that you've done so we can see where you're getting all this information.
Boy, oh boy. It's been a whole variety of things. I've done a lot of nutritional counseling over the years. I'm a board certified in holistic nutrition through the National Association of Nutrition Professionals. I'm also certified as a nutritional therapy practitioner, certified nutritional therapist through the Nutritional Therapy Association. I've been hired by the State of Washington Institute of Mental Health to create training videos on the subject of nutrition and mental health for state healthcare workers on all levels. I've helped to teach coursework. I've given lectures.
Okay.
And of course, I have my own radio show. But
oh, you have your own radio show too?
I do.
Oh, cool.
On Voice America's Health and Wellness channel.
Voice America is it called?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk a bit about the fat again. We talked with a doctor who's been having some really interesting results with her husband, and she's a preemie, she's a baby doctor, so this was not her field, but her husband presented Alzheimer's, and so she started looking into it and found her way to coconut oil and also MCT oil.
Right, medium-chain triglycerides.
Yeah, which is pretty interesting. I've been taking that for about a week now, and there's something kind of good about that. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm just taking a couple tablespoons a day. And she has found really incredible, very, very quick results. I mean, in just a few days, her husband started to be a little bit more awake, you know, and aware of just getting... And she contends, and she talked about the ketones, and I want you to talk about it and explain to us what these are, but she contends that, as in the body, the brain cells also get insulin resistant, and that these medium-chain triglycerides are one of the easiest ways to get food into the brain cells, and why it works with Alzheimer's. What do you think about that?
Well, that's a bunch of questions, actually, in a way. But the brain actually doesn't respond that much to insulin. That's one of the problems, because it makes the brain extremely vulnerable to a very damaging process called glycation, which is the manner in which the brain actually ages.
So it's supposed to be insulin resistant?
Well, the brain responds some to insulin, but not that much, and it can't. That's one of the problems, that the brain really can't become that insulin resistant because it has to be able to use sugar for fuel in an emergency. The brain always has to have its options open, because it's such a vitally important organ for most of us in order to survive. So the problem, of course, and as Alzheimer's can basically be looked upon, there is research now actually starting to define it this way, as sort of a form of brain diabetes, as sort of a state of advanced brain glycation, brain neuropathy, so to speak.
Glycation meaning?
Glycation is a process by which sugar will combine with proteins and fats and things in our bodies and cause them to become sort of sticky and misshapen and start to malfunction. It is the manner in which we age, and the combination of sugar with protein, the sort of caramelization that occurs in the body, creates these byproducts called advanced glycosylation end products, which create inflammation, and also just cause things to start breaking down. They can also cause DNA to mutate, and it's essentially how we age. It's sugar will attract a lot of oxidation and free radical activity, and these advanced glycosylation end products also generate a lot of free radical activity. And so it's just not a good thing. So when you have a brain that's bathed in glucose all the time, because you have somebody who's a carnivore and they're feeding on starch and sugar all day long, it makes the brain vulnerable to a great deal of damage. And what are these amyloid plaques? They're basically these sort of sticky protein entanglements in the brain, these glycated protein entanglements that, of course, become unable, you know, that are non-functional, that sort of get in the way of the brain function. And you have the brain fundamentally degenerating.
So so then that's a case for not using high fructose corn syrup.
Well, that's one of about 1,000 cases for not using high fructose.
Fat,
on the other hand, fat does not glycate things. If fat is a very safe form of fuel for the brain, the brain is mostly made up of fat.
But not Crisco.
No. Well, there we're talking about hydrogenated vegetable oils.
So there's fat and there's fat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's one of the other things I go into at great length in my book, are all of the myths surrounding the idea. Fat is just tossed around in the media and with sort of generalized banter about health as being just sort of one sort of general substance. And of course, fat is an extremely complex array of extremely different compounds that vary tremendously in the way that our body absorbs and utilizes them, digests and processes them, the way they get used metabolically. And different fats have different roles to play in our health and different functions. And you cannot just sort of generalize. You can't even just generalize about saturated fat, because there are long-chain saturated fats, there are short- and medium-chain saturated fats. All the naturally saturated fats have some role to play in our health and well-being, and are fine in, you know, normal natural quantities. The unnaturally saturated fats, of course, are the trans fats, or the hydrogenated fats that that we need to be a lot more concerned about, because they don't really exist in nature in that manner for the most part.
Like the heated oils in restaurants and fast food places.
Well,
that's a whole other thing.
That's rancid fats are different from trans fats.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, they're not the same things. Trans fats are actually produced in a laboratory.
Oh, okay.
By artificially saturating unsaturated fats.
Like hydrogenated fats to make crackers crispy.
Hydrogenation is what produces trans fats.
Right.
There is a misconception that trans fats are produced by overheating oils, and that's not how they're produced.
But rancidity certainly does.
Rancidity is an entirely separate problem, and rancid fats tend to produce a particularly aggressive form of free radical that is a nasty thing we don't want. So we'd never want to overcook our fats, although saturated fats, by their very nature, with all the talk about antioxidants, saturated fats, by their very nature, are innately resistant to oxidation. So it actually makes them the best possible choice for cooking. If we're going to be, cooking something on the stove, I want the most saturated fat I can get my hands on, be it, coconut oil would be probably the single best choice. That's the most resistant to oxidation.
How about palm kernel oil?
Yep, that's also very
good. That's a good one. Yep. And I can recall, 30 years ago, they used to use beef tallow to fry the French fries at McDonald's.
Right.
Which was a good choice.
Those were better days for McDonald's.
Good choice.
I won't say they were good days, but they were better days. Before things got complicated and the whole myth about vegetable oils being the better alternative got into the picture, and then of course they started using hydrogenated vegetable oils for this. And
then remember they took the coconut oil out of the theaters, what, about 10 years ago or 15 years ago?
They
said all that stuff's bad.
There are a few theaters now trying to bring that back and saying, yeah, we use real coconut oil. And
oh, really?
Yeah, here and there. It's starting to happen. But, you know, be that as it may, the vast majority of what gets used out there commercially is not just bad, but devastatingly bad for your health.
And also, I think it's careful when you and I sit here on a January morning and we talk about saturated fat, there's a big difference between, say, a piece of fat on a grass-fed animal and one that is feeding antibiotics and growth hormones and corn.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's like, that's a huge difference.
Yeah, the fatty acid makeup of grass-fed versus feedlot-fed meat is, it's night and day different.
Oh, the fatty acid makeup.
Yeah, the fatty acid makeup. So, for instance, you know, there's almost no omega-3 content whatsoever in grains. So what you have when you have the meat of an animal that has been feedlot fed at the end of its life, is an animal with a disproportionately high level of omega-6 fatty acids, making up the fatty acid profile of the meat. And you know, of course, omega-6s are in unnaturally high amounts, are credited with creating a lot of inflammatory problems.
But can we say, I think it's important to say, now you correct me if I'm wrong, but there are omega-6s and there are omega-6s. You have omega-6 from whole organic nuts, like walnuts and things like that, or sunflower seeds and all these. That's a whole difference from an omega-6 from a canola oil.
I mean, omega-6 fatty acids are omega-6 fatty acids. Now, if you're talking about canola oil, all commercial canola oil, all commercial soybean oil are partially hydrogenated as part of their deodorization process. And that's a whole different ball of wax. Canola oil does have a rather high proportion of omega-6 fats. It also contains some naturally occurring alpha-linolenic acid, which is an omega-3, but that's what gets hydrogenated out during the deodorization process because it's part of what makes canola oil so unstable. Canola oil is a horrible, horrible oil to cook with, by the way.
Well, Nora, Professor Brian Peska was on the show on Monday. You familiar with him?
Yes, I am.
And he argues that, you know, that a lot of the omega-6 talk, the baby's being thrown out with the bathwater because that we need these essential omega-6s.
Of course.
Okay.
All we need some omega-6, and we also need to have a balanced amount of omega-3s with that. The problem is, you know, we want that ratio to be like 1 to 1 or 1 to 3 or so. But unfortunately, in our culture right now, it's at least 20 to 1 omega-6s to omega-3s. Omega-3s really kind of aren't in the food supply anymore. And parent form omega-3, alpha-linolenic acid, right, for instance, that comes from like flax oil and things and walnuts
nuts and seeds, yeah.
Actually, we don't make that good a use of as humans. There's an enzyme called delta-6 desaturase that that gets used by both omega-6s and omega-3s in their parent form to elongate into the derivative forms like DHA and EPA, which are the active forms, the most active forms of omega-3 in our body. If you have perfect metabolism, you have a perfectly healthy liver, there you don't have any deficiencies of any kind, if you consume flax oil, you are lucky if you are able to convert anywhere from, you know, 3 to 5% of that flax oil that you've consumed into EPA. You may not end up converting any into DHA.
Well, Peskin argues that this whole need for so much EPA and DHA from fish oils is something that people just made up.
No, they didn't just make it up. And it's very clear that that has been a primary source of omega-3s, or, you know, for humans for a very long time, for as long as we've been hunter-gatherers. In animals, we consume EPA and DHA in its preformed
Just all animals or just fish?
No, if you are eating the meat from a grass-fed animal that has been fed nothing but grass, you may get as much omega-3, as much EPA, DHA in that grass-fed piece of meat as you would per gram in a piece of wild-caught fish.
Oh, yes, exactly. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. But Peskin argues that's exactly why you don't want to go out and eat fish oil, because you're getting a pharmacological dose of it.
Oh, that's absurd because, you know, with all due respect, because I like some of what Dr. Peskin has to say, but I think he misses the boat on this one.
Mm-hmm.
That we actually do a rather, you know, poor job of making those conversions from parent form omega-3 to elongated form omega-3. And some people cannot do it at all. Some people are of a, if you're of Northern European descent, Celtic descent, if you're of Native descent at all, you may not be able to make those conversions at all. That Delta 6 desaturase enzyme may not be functional in you at all. And you would be entirely dependent upon getting your,
official.
And, you know, and again, I mean, again, we're hunter-gatherers for crying out loud. We were designed, you know, to get a lot of our nutrients from animal source foods.
Here's an email from Tonio. How does the glycation occur? Ogynous Voldoplanets, who's a raw meat kind of, he's raw everything, including meat, and he talks about glycation products from eating cooked proteins and fats.
Yeah, because the sugars, because there's still, even in meat, there is some glycogen, you know, that's sort of stored. We store some sugars and starches in our muscle tissue for, you know, purposes of our supplying energy to fueling our muscles in an emergency and all that kind of thing for peak effort. And so, you know, some of that glycogen is going to combine with the protein and create some of these advanced glycosylation end products. I actually tend to, I select meat, the best quality meat that I can find, and I do enjoy some eating some meat raw, you know, carpaccios and tartars and things like that, and I think it's wonderful for you. It's much easier to digest, and there's something inherently, you know, more natural in some respects to raw meat. I don't know that it's practical to eat all raw meat all the time. We've certainly been, for at least 350,000 years anyway, eating some meat cooked, and I think, you know, I tend to advocate cooking, you know, your meat minimally, unless it's coming from a questionable source, in which case you may want to cook it a little more thoroughly to prevent foodborne illness, and that's the trade-off. But meat is actually much easier to digest
if
it's minimally cooked.
Some people suggest, Nora, that if you sear the outside of all the edges, that's where the possible bacteria, parasite stuff is.
Yeah.
Everything, and just leave the inside as raw as you'd like, that's a pretty good choice.
Always say if you're going to consume your meat raw, please spend the extra money and get it from the best quality possible sources.
Right. So. And we like to advocate around One Radio Network because my feelings for the four-leggeds is that try to find people that are actually harvesting these animals in the field with one shot, and they do it. And there are people that are doing it.
Yeah.
So the animal does not have to go through the whole traumatic slaughterhouse trip, and you don't have that slaughterhouse karma stuff, and you support harvesting animals the way they should be.
Right.
Which is in the field. We know a fellow in South Texas that actually does a whole ceremonial thing before he kills a grass-fed buffalo.
Oh, and I know people around here who
and
do
pray
that sort of
and
thing
give
as well.
Thanks to them. And, oh, man, it's so, I mean, I don't like killing animals, you know. Who likes killing anything?
Right.
But if we can use this and some people need this food, I mean, there are better ways to do it. I know that's way up on the scale on 1 to 10. That's a 10.
Well, and that's, you know, that's an important consideration.
I
actually look upon sort of the, you know, the commercial livestock industry is a bit of an evil empire, and I don't personally support that. I don't give that, you know, that my business.
You don't vote with your dollar.
No,
there.
But I don't consider the alternative to that to be veganism. There are many farmers, ranchers out there who are working extremely hard at great expense, and you know, to do the right thing and to raise their animals in a healthful, humane manner out in fresh air and sunshine, eating the foods that were natural for them to eat. In other words, fresh green grass, grains and corn are not natural foods, and soybeans are not natural foods for cattle. And looking to also process the animals when the time comes in a humane fashion. And yes, these people are out there. That's where I get my meat.
They're out there. Yeah, we know another place around San Antonio that does deer like that. And they actually, get this, they actually shoot them at night because they don't want them all scared and running around.
Well,
and
there's something to consider.
So interesting.
Stress hormones end up in the food that we eat, and those same stress hormones can affect us too.
Yeah. Let's take this phone call. What's your first name and where are you calling from? Hello.
Hello, it's Yuri from Ukraine.
from the Ukraine. Go ahead.
Yeah.
You're on the air.
My name is I have several questions about the possible side effects of ketogenic diet. Obviously, cortisol is needed to convert protein into glucose. Will it put any additional stress on the adrenals?
No. As a matter of fact, I see that the diets that are based in sugar are much, much harder on the adrenals than fats are. Fat is a very, again, it's the fuel that we were designed to burn on an ongoing basis throughout the day very naturally. It's very even burning. It's very long lasting. It's like putting a log on the fire. With sugar, what you're getting are these spikes of, you know, when you eat a piece of something starchy, you eat a potato or something like that, and your blood sugar spikes, then insulin, of course, acting to get the you know, because your body's obsessed with maintaining the lowest necessary level of blood sugar at all times, insulin sweeps that sugar out of the bloodstream, and then all of a sudden, you know, the blood sugar, if you're dependent on blood sugar, is suddenly too low, and your adrenals have to fire. Your adrenals then fire to try to drive the blood sugar back up again. And you're on a roller coaster ride. I see cases of adrenal exhaustion all the time, every day in my practice. And in almost every single case, in fact, in every single case that I can think of from the get-go, blood sugar dysregulation has been a major part of that adrenal exhaustion. It's a primary vector for adrenal problems. And the degree to which people can convert to being a fat burner instead of a sugar burner takes the burden off the adrenals enormously. It's the whole idea that ketones are somehow some sort of toxin or, you know, waste product or whatever is a myth. And, you know, the state of ketosis basically means that you're essentially that you're burning fat for fuel. And I don't know who doesn't want that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a good explanation. And, another question. I have been eating nothing but meat and fat for around 2 months now, and I'm still having clogged urine from time to time. Is it normal?
You're still having what from time to time?
What problem?
Clogged urine from time to time.
Cloudy urine?
Yeah.
Yeah, your phone is not very clear.
Yeah, I'm having a little bit of a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, without
cloudy urine, like
cloudy.
You know,
urine,
and again,
and ketosis.
I can't understand.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah, I'm having difficulty.
Can I move away from your phone a second, about an inch, and say it again? What the problem is?
I'm talking about that I've been eating nothing but meat and fat for around 4 months now.
Right.
And I'm still having cloudy urine.
Cloudy urine.
Well, without doing a urinalysis and without knowing more about what's going on with you, with your blood chemistry and everything else, it's impossible to comment on what that would actually be. There could be a lot of different reasons for that. How are you feeling?
Actually, I'm feeling better than on carbohydrates. It's like you said, it takes over the stress from the adrenals, you know, and I'm certainly dealing with some hormonal problems.
Yeah.
So it's better, but it's probably the only concern that I'm having with this diet.
Yeah. I can't comment on what's going on with you medically. I'm not in a position to do that. I'm not a, you know, licensed practitioner. I'm not going to try to guess at what is going on with that. That would be the kind of thing that would need to be professionally evaluated, and I, you know, urge you to do that if you're concerned about it. But I also urge you to listen to your body and listen to how you're feeling. If you're feeling and functioning better, then that's something worth also paying attention to.
Okay, Yuri, thanks for the call. Hi, what's your first name? Let's see. Hello?
Hello.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air. Let me do something. My controls here are a little messed up. Stay right there. I'm going to put you on hold, and then I'm going to drop this. There you are. Where are you calling from? What's your first name?
I'm calling from Maine. Oh. My first name is Amy.
Okay, Amy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I have been a type 1 diabetic for 38 years, and for the last 6.5 years, I've been on a raw food diet, hoping to be able to discontinue my insulin injections.
Now, vegan and vegetarian or raw food?
I was, at first, for 6.5 years, I was raw food vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And worked really hard on, I did a lot of fasting and all kinds of cleansing and things like that. But I was not able to get off my insulin. I did get the insulin way down to 6 units for a couple of days, but every time I started to eat again, it would climb back up. Long story short, I've become interested in changing my diet and doing some experimenting, so I'm calling.
Yeah.
I have introduced some meat, but every time I eat meat, my blood sugars go high, and I just wonder if Nora has any suggestions, or if her book is helpful, and what is her belief with long-term type 1 diabetics being able to get off of their insulin?
Well, you know, with that kind of case, again, it's a medical thing that is...
Well, just talk in generalities.
But I'm just asking your opinion.
Yeah,
I'm not asking for medical advice.
Right, right. But generally speaking, you know, type 1 diabetes is going to be a little different for everybody that has it. You can't overly generalize and say, well, if you do this, you're going to completely get off. I know that there is a good deal of research around vitamin D, for instance, being something that if you take enough of it early on, there seems to be some evidence that can actually help to regenerate the pancreatic beta cells and restore healthier functioning. So because, you know, you're dealing with an autoimmune issue, and so your primary issue is immune. And vitamin D is something that is critically important when you're dealing with autoimmune kinds of things. Food sensitivities are another major issue when you're dealing with anything having to do with autoimmune. So those are things for you to look at. With respect to what I advocate, I'm not advocating eating tons of protein, which is often as when people talk about sort of paleolithic diets and whatever, they envision somebody just, you know, gorging themselves on steak and all that kind of thing. I actually advocate a fairly moderate amount of protein. I probably eat maybe 6 or 7 ounces of protein in a day, a couple ounces, you know, really per meal. And so at that level, I wouldn't expect that you would be adversely impacting your blood sugar to any significant extent. Again, when somebody is accustomed to burning sugar as opposed to fat as a primary source of fuel, and you're really being driven by carbohydrates, your body becomes extremely efficient at converting other things to sugar as well, namely protein, from the diet and also from your bones and from your muscle, which is a vector for osteoporosis and some other things. So by keeping the amount of protein moderated to just the amount that you need in order to effect your own maintenance and repair, you avoid, I think, a lot of those pitfalls that are associated with excess protein consumption, a lot of potential pitfalls. And so I know people firsthand who are type 1 diabetics who have been able to radically reduce their insulin need, eating the diet that I advocate, which is very, very easy on the body and actually tends to be very strengthening also for the immune system.
Are you still there, Amy?
I am.
Okay,
I am
good. Go ahead. Any follow-up kind of questions or comments for her?
Not really. I think I'm just going to buy your book and,
try to,
you know,
Amy, let me ask you,
I do think that you're going to find things that are really, really useful for you in there.
Amy, have you played around with getting more fat, as Nora was suggesting, into your diet? Has that helped, or have you tried that?
I did a couple of months ago. I've introduced, the only fats I eat right now are coconut oil and olive oil. But I also did some experimenting with raw butter, but it seemed to be, my body was happy with it for a few days, and then it said, nope, No, it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
So with the water, it could just be because of the casein content. There are trace amounts of casein, and a lot of people with immune dysfunction, you know, and autoimmune issues, have gluten and casein kinds of sensitivities. So that may be the issue for you with respect to butter. You could try ghee and see if that works any
better.
Now,
when you do ghee, does that take out the casein?
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, Amy, stick with One Radio Network. We're really kind of doing some deep work on this whole autoimmune issue, because I suspect, and this is just my opinion, which means nothing around here, by the way, that there are some deep-seated bacterial and viral infections in many people that the immune system is not happy camper. And we're doing work with that in the interview next Monday with Amy Prohl, who is the genesis of Bacteriality. Very interesting stuff. So this may be something you want to investigate as well.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, sweetie, thanks for calling. Yeah, you know, I didn't realize, however, Miss Nora, that the casein and the gluten intolerance was tied into autoimmunity.
Big time.
How does that work?
Well, hard to put this sort of thing into a nutshell. But they're, gluten and casein are very large protein molecules. They're not natural foods for us.
Mm-hmm.
They're relatively recently introduced, and they're very difficult for us to digest. And if we have any kind of digestive impairment at all, which a lot of people do,
yes,
a great many. In fact, I'd be venturing to say most people do,
like a leaky gut kind of an idea.
You end up creating, you know, particularly with gluten, that increases there's a protein associated with that called zonulin, which helps to regulate intestinal permeability and increases intestinal permeability, which is one of the vectors, of course, for, you know, creating that whole leaky gut thing. And then you have immunoglobulins in your body, you know, reacting to the proteins coming through that weren't supposed to get through as antigens, and then your immune system is reacting to things. And and as these proteins incorporate into your system, then you start reacting to yourself, attacking yourself. And gluten and casein are notorious as primary sources of major food sensitivity issues. I think there are probably more people than not that have some degree or another of issue, whether they happen to be aware of it or not.
So that's why the folks like our future guest to come is Datis Kazarian.
Yeah, Karazian. He's actually one of my mentors.
Oh,
so.
Well, we're going to have him on the air soon, and he talks a lot about getting rid of the casein and the gluten away for the autoimmune thyroid stuff.
Absolutely, he will give you a
brilliant
explanation
pretty sharp guy?
For that.
You think he's a pretty sharp guy?
I think he's a pretty sharp guy. Okay. I don't agree with him with everything, but I think he's a pretty sharp guy.
And your website is primalbody-primalmind.com, right?
That's correct.
Well, what about then the Weston A. Price Foundation on their love affair with raw milk?
Right.
What about that? Because I know that you have a lot of respect for the work of Weston A. Price.
I do. I have a tremendous amount of respect for the work of Weston Price. I have a great deal of respect for the Weston A. Price Foundation. I'm even a member. And so, you know, I think that if you are not casein sensitive, and again, when milk is raw as opposed to pasteurized, pasteurization tends to denature protein. It causes protein to change its form and shape, and it becomes much more resistant to digestion once it's been cooked. So what you're talking about with raw milk is a casein molecule that is going to be easier to digest. Also, with raw milk, there are enzymes present in the milk that also help facilitate its digestion. And if you have cultured that raw milk, so as to create, you know, the lacto-fermented types of foods and things like that, you further help to break down the proteins, and, you know, you have, you know, microorganisms, you have enzymes, and you have a much more pre-digested food that is easier for people to tolerate. But I have a casein sensitivity, and even raw milk products I can't tolerate, although
I can do a little bit of raw cream, and that seems to be okay for me. The casein is trace enough in that I don't seem to react to that.
You would think there'd be more casein in raw cream, more concentrated, no?
No, because cream is almost pure fat.
Oh, so that's why
most of the protein is out of that.
So casein is a protein.
Yes.
I see. So then that's why it's easy enough to get the casein out of the butter when you make ghee.
Yes.
Because you cook out the...
Because you're taking out the milk solids milk solids are where the casein exists.
Then does
butter.
The ghee have the really nice benefits we like from grass-fed butter without the casein?
Well, yeah, most of them. I mean, with ghee, of course, you have a product that's been heated and whatnot, and so there may be certain components, you know, what the Western price called the X factor or whatever, that get broken down in cooking, as in pasteurization. But you're going to, if it's from a grass-fed source, you're going to have conjugated linoleic acid. You're going to have, really a nice complement of, you're going to have, wonderful vitamin A content. You're going to have selenium. You're going to have some really great things. I think butter is a wonderful food, for anybody that can tolerate it. And the more purely pasture-fed the butter is, the better. And obviously, if you can get it organically, raised pasture and that sort of a thing, so much the better. Although I'll take pasture-fed to just organic any day.
Sure, I think so too. Because it's interesting when you say the word organic, it sounds great, but if you're feeding the animals organic corn and soy and stuff, I mean, I'd rather, who wants that?
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
I'm glad it's organic. God love them, but that's not what they were meant to eat.
Well, and the whole organic standard, too, has gotten so eroded as to almost become meaningless after a while. I still tend to prefer organic when I'm going out and buying vegetables and whatever else, but I don't have any illusions about that being, necessarily perfect.
Well, I sure liked it better when they had the little regional organic places,
Right, right.
That's
why I buy most of my vegetables now, farmers markets and co-ops and things like that patronize local sources.
Because when the gov gets in, the gov, the one we love, when they get involved, boy, they tend to screw up about much about anything.
Ain't that the case, yeah.
What about eggs? You like eggs?
I actually have a pretty strong sensitivity to chicken eggs, so I don't eat chicken eggs. I think they're wonderful food for anybody who does tolerate them well. I actually do okay, though, with duck eggs. So,
now, why would you suspect someone like you that know, and others who may be sensitive to them? Is that, once again, an autoimmune issue where you're creating some kind
it's
of...
It's not antibody? Autoimmune. Food sensitivities are not necessarily synonymous with autoimmune.
Okay.
They
just DNA, genetics, kind of ancestral
some
stuff?
Some of it's genetic, yes,
mm-hmm.
Ancestral and all that kind of thing. And also, I think if we've overconsumed a certain food, I mean, for years I ate eggs every single morning.
I see.
And, you have to be a little careful about that sometimes. And particularly if your digestion isn't purely wonderful, which mine wasn't for a while, then you set yourself up for the development sometimes of these food sensitivities. So, changing things up a little bit and giving yourself a little bit of a variety, or at the very least, ensuring that you are getting adequate producing adequate hydrochloric acid, or that you're taking adequate hydrochloric acid with meals, so that you're thoroughly digesting the proteins that you consume. If you're able to break them down well enough through the action of pepsin, hydrochloric acid, and your pancreatic enzymes, then once they become amino acids, they're not doing you any harm at all. But you're not chewing well, or you're not digesting well, and these things are able to get into your small intestine and cause irritation and whatever else, then you're setting yourself up for problems.
Hmm. What about cholesterol, that main number that everybody talks about? Oh. Well, my cholesterol number is 140. Mine's 180.
Yeah.
Where's Nora?
I could probably go on for about 2 hours about that.
No, that's a big one.
In fact, I can get into a rant about that. I do have a good article on my website about cholesterol, but I see cholesterol in and of itself is fundamentally a non-issue. Now, somebody like Datis Krazin will tell you that it matters only if you have when you have inflammatory processes and then you have cholesterol becoming rancid and oxidized. Certainly oxidized cholesterol is potentially a problem. But cholesterol in and of itself tends to be inherently a bit resistant to oxidation. And so I actually see cholesterol of almost any number to be in and of itself a virtual non-issue. However, I do see it as an indicator. In other words, if somebody has a cholesterol that's like, 300 or something, what that tells me is that there's something going on in their body for which cholesterol is needed. We have to understand that cholesterol is a pretty vital substance in our bodies. We use it to make our hormones. It is our body's version of duct tape, and it gets basically circulated around in a way that helps to patch up lesions wherever they occur in the body. It's an incredibly important part of our cellular membranes, giving them integrity, helping with their semi-permeability. So cholesterol has a tremendous variety of roles to play, and it's so important, in fact, that every cell in your body has a means of manufacturing its own supply. We produce a couple thousand milligrams of cholesterol every single day. And if we're not getting cholesterol in our diets, our body will become more efficient at producing cholesterol from carbohydrates in the diet. There's an enzyme in the liver called HMG-CoA reductase that, and I realize that's a technical term.
That's
but,
a big one, yeah.
But,
yeah.
But it upregulates in the absence of dietary cholesterol and becomes very, very active at converting carbohydrates in the diet, starch and sugar, to cholesterol, because we have to have cholesterol, or our body thinks it's in a state of starvation. We've always consumed it.
Yeah. Well, what if we were vegetarian or vegan, and
you're asking and, for problems,
and then we weren't eating some, good carbohydrates, whatever those are. Well, then your cholesterol could get too low, and you can't make hormones, and nobody's happy.
Right. I worry much more about somebody whose cholesterol levels are too low,
right,
as in, below 150, than so-called too high. If I see somebody whose cholesterol is like 160 or below, I'm very nervous about them. I consider that an ominous sign in their blood chemistry work.
Well,
and I begin looking immediately around for other things that may point to what may be going on. But we know that low levels of cholesterol are highly correlated with all-cause mortality, including things like cancers, including things like depression, cognitive disorders.
But wasn't the China study, didn't they come out with all these numbers saying that the lower the cholesterol, the longer the life?
I very strongly question those findings. And
why?
Because that doesn't seem to bear out with many, 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 many other studies that have shown that cholesterol levels that are too low, that are below 150, for instance, tend to be correlated with higher rates of mortality from all causes. And we also know
that... Do you have those studies on your website?
I list a lot of that stuff in the back of my book.
In the back of your book?
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting also in your book that you have a quote here from one of the top researchers in the Framingham study, which is probably where some of this cholesterol stuff started.
Well,
was it before then?
Well, no. I mean, the problem is...
But anyway, he says that there's no science to prove that this saturated cholesterol thing... doesn't have any evidence to support that it's bad for it.
Right. Right. And so...
So what was behind the whole cholesterol thing?
Well, that's another thing that could take a couple of hours.
Can you give us...
I do actually recommend that there's a wonderful article on the Weston A. Price Foundation website, westonaprice.org, called The Oiling of America. And if you want a really thorough history and a thorough understanding of what that is all about... You won't be left with any questions or doubts anymore by the time you're done reading that article. It summarizes it brilliantly.
Well, and the amount of statins that are being sold, I mean, you have to connect the dots there. I mean, even in the most, if you just flew in from a different planet, say, well, I'm objective here. I mean, I think it's close to $5 billion, maybe $4 billion of people lowering their cholesterols to 120, 110.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... It's curious, I think.
I consider it scary. And you also have to it's important to know why that's happening, how that's happening, what they're using. For instance, people who consume really high levels of polyunsaturated oils oftentimes will drive down their serum cholesterol.
Yes.
Because the body is basically, these highly polyunsaturated fats tend to kind of diminish the integrity of cellular membranes. They make them sort of too sort of weak and floppy. You have to realize that cholesterol and saturated fat help to give cellular membranes some integrity.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
So there the needs polys to be, kind of make them wimpy?
Yeah, basically, kind of give you wimpy cellular membranes.
Who wants
so
that?
So what happens is that cholesterol gets driven to those areas in the body to try to shore things up. And so in the process, you're lowering what's happening in the bloodstream. Because you have to realize, when you get your cholesterol checked, all you're looking at is what's happening in the bloodstream. You've got anywhere from 100 to 150,000 milligrams of cholesterol floating around your whole body, and it's going to be distributed according to need. Again, if your cholesterol is elevated past a certain point, what it tells me is that there's something going on in your bloodstream for which cholesterol is needed. Very often, people who have high carbohydrate diets will have elevated cholesterol. People with who are experiencing a tremendous amount of stress or infection are also may be experiencing elevated levels of cholesterol.
Hmm.
And also thyroid problems. If a person has low-functioning thyroid, I always expect to see cholesterol elevated. And trying to go around and you know, again, you have to realize cholesterol is sort of our body's version of duct tape. It runs around patching up lesions, and, you know, it has a job to do.
So at what number are you concerned? We've had folks that contend that, like, the low 200s is just fine, thank you.
Well, I agree. I think that that is just fine. I don't worry about cholesterol in and of itself at any number. Again, I look at cholesterol not as an endpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I look at cholesterol as an indicator.
Something's going on.
In other words, I don't see cholesterol as being the cause of heart disease or of anything else any more than gray hair is the cause of old age.
I don't think it's ever been proven to be the cause.
It has never been proven to be the cause.
No, I think that...
But there's a great deal of financially vested interest,
sure, sure,
and political interest in perpetuating that perception.
And is it entirely possible that when we have bacterial, viral, parasitical infections that maybe cause inflammation and scarring, that the cholesterol is trying to patch,
yes,
them up, and you cut open the artery and say, oh, there's cholesterol, you better get that stuff out of there.
Right, and by trying to take statin drugs in order to stamp out cholesterol, it's the equivalent of stopping and getting rid of and blaming the firemen that come to put out the fire.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, instead of changing your foreign policy, put full body pats on everybody in the world.
Yeah.
But that's another story.
That's a whole other story.
I have an email here that will kind of end with this one. Thanks for staying over, because it's been quite interesting, Nora. An emailer sent some work from Dr. Joel Furman. Substantial work in determining nutrient density per calorie in foods.
Yes.
And so, like, if you look at this graph, it's pretty interesting. The raw leafy greens, they are the most nutrient dense per calorie, according to this. And you go way down with the eggs and the red meat and the fat, they're like the lowest nutrients per calorie. So,
well,
that makes an argument for a more vegetarian diet, right?
In theory, it makes an argument for that. The problem, of course, with this argument is that you and I don't have four stomachs. We don't have the ability to extract every single nutrient from plant-based foods. We're just simply not designed that way. We're designed to get a certain amount of nutrition from plant-based foods, but cellulose is largely indigestible to us, and a lot of the nutrients and minerals and things like that end up kind of bound up in that cellulose in a way that makes it rather hard for us to get at it.
That's what Peskin said on Monday.
Yeah, and now cooking.
Well, it helps it. It breaks
certain
it down.
Vegetables,
right?
A little bit, you know, a little steaming, a little sauteing, can actually help break down some of that cellulose a little bit and make things more absorbable. Also, a lot of the nutrients in, like, leafy greens and things that are fat soluble, like vitamin K, vitamin and beta carotene, for instance, those are fat soluble nutrients. So we need a certain amount of fat present in the diet at the time that we consume those foods in order to absorb and make good use of those.
Say that again now. So, like, something like kale, collards, those kinds of things, which,
yeah,
are really herbivores, will eat those, right?
Right, but we're not herbivores.
I know
we
we're not.
We produce hydrochloric acid.
We're not herbivores. All right.
Right.
So to better utilize those, we have to have fat.
Well, in order to utilize the fat-soluble nutrients and make better, be able to absorb those nutrients more efficiently, we do need a certain amount of fat present. So a solution to that might be ever so lightly cooking or steaming that kale. I'm not saying you always have to cook it. I eat vegetables both raw and lightly cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And then throwing a little butter on that, or olive oil if you prefer, is a perfectly acceptable way to approach that. But again, you have to realize that as hunter-gatherers as we are, and we are not herbivores as human beings, we are not. We don't have cloven hooves. We don't have four stomachs. We don't chew our cud. At least nobody I know does. And we're not designed to be extracting all of our nutrition from plant-based foods. And so it's you know, what you can accomplish in a laboratory in terms of nutrient density, and what you can actually accomplish in vivo, you know, utilizing a naturally functioning human digestive tract, are two entirely different things. And I think that those findings are a bit misleading.
Because if you do it in other words, it might be relevant for a cow.
It's very relevant for a cow.
So that's why they eat grass.
Right. And all day long, I might add, in order to extract the amount of nutrition they need.
They eat a lot of grass.
They pretty much have their faces to the ground all day long, which I personally got better things to do.
Well, I don't know. It just depends who you're with. But,
right.
Okay, finally then, this interesting graph that you had in your book, Primal Body, Primal Mind, about the amount of fats turning from animal fats to these kind of industrialized fats since 1910. Boy, that's pretty stunning.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning. So, you know, people talk about the high-fat American diet. Well, yeah, in a manner of speaking, we're consuming more fats, more Americans are consuming more fats from a natural or unhealthy sources. And from vegetable sources, which, by the way, our ancestors never, you know, other than some of the traditional oils like coconut oil, which is not that difficult to extract, and olive oil, our ancestors wouldn't have thought to take like a sesame seed and crush it, or a sunflower seed and crush it and extract the oil from that and then start frying things in it. Now, I sort of mistakenly use sesame oil as an example.
Because that's a pretty good one.
It's actually not a bad one because there is a naturally occurring antioxidant called sesamin in sesame oil that is actually activated in the presence of heat that helps to protect the integrity of the oil somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't tend to high heat cook with sesame oil, but I do like it as an accent because it adds a wonderful flavor. But it's extremely high in omega-6s, so you know, you want to make sure that your diet is adequately balanced with omega-3s if you're going to be doing a lot of that type of thing.
How do you explain, Nora, excuse me, how do you explain how coconut oil could be so good for us and people who, you know, for thousands of years never have seen a coconut tree?
Right. Well, because they're medium, again, there are fatty acids making up coconut oil that are present in other things, but seem to be extra concentrated there that have some beneficial things for us. Now, medium-chain triglycerides are digested very differently from longer-chain fats. They actually bypass the gallbladder. They pass directly into portal blood and are used preferentially for energy. So it's very difficult to actually store the fat from coconut oil on your body
you
as
just
body
use it.
Fat.
You and just in use fact, it, don't you?
Pardon?
You just use it, don't you?
Yeah, you pretty much just use it.
Right.
Also, about half of the fatty acid makeup of coconut oil is something called lauric acid, which in the body converts to a substance called monolaurin. Monolaurin may be the single most potent natural antiviral agent known.
Really?
Yeah.
Monolaurin.
And so it's very potently antimicrobial and very wonderful, you know, very good for assisting our immune system to do its work. It's somewhat theorized that areas of the world where like third world countries where a lot of, like Thailand, where there's a lot of coconut consumed, you know, where there would otherwise be, you know, maybe some questionable sanitation with the water supply and whatever, that people there don't seem to suffer those ill effects as much, possibly because of the high degree of, high amounts of coconut oil consumed in those countries.
Perhaps that's why many people say that doing the oil pulling with coconut oil is so beneficial.
Yeah, I have heard some things about that.
For those who don't know what that is, you can just take a glob of coconut oil in your mouth and just kind of swish it around and do all kinds of stuff for about 10 minutes in the morning, supposedly.
Yeah.
It does a lot of good things for you.
Spit it out, yeah.
Spit it out.
I've heard some things
sounds
said about
kind of,
that.
I do it. It's fun.
Yeah.
It gives you something to do in the morning while you're exercising.
Yeah. Well, that Dr. Mary Enig, who is arguably the world's foremost scientific expert on dietary fat and human health, she has actually come out recently and stated that up to a good 3 tablespoons a day of coconut oil is likely to be sufficient to protect against common viral infections. And even, you know, of course, she was referencing also the sort of H1N1 thing, which really want to start getting
you
into
don't
that
even
because
go there.
I'm just going to get angry and frustrated, but
well,
don't get me started. As my
have
blog
you ever,
says,
have you ever made or had coconut cream?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Wow.
It's ambrosial.
And you know, folks, if you ever want to have some fun, is make some coconut cream or buy some. I guess they have it online. I don't know, but you can make it with the right kind of juicer. And you take a tablespoon of that like every couple hours, you can go all day and you just feel great. I mean, I do. I don't know. I could just eat that for days and never eat anything else. I mean, it just works. I don't know why. I guess you got the fuel, maybe.
Yeah. Well, there's this again, you know, coconut is pretty energizing. Hmm. People generally find they get pretty energized eating a lot of coconut. So, yeah.
Yeah, especially if you're in the South Pacific chasing girls, right?
Or well,
letting girls chase you.
Okay.
Okay, girl. Well, Nora, you're a very interesting lady. Thanks so much for spending a lot of time with us. And it's Nora
it's starting to break apart now.
Yeah. Say it again.
Yeah, Gidgoudis.
Yes. Nora Gidgoudis, Primal Body, Primal Mind. And your website is?
primalbody-primalmind.com.
Uh-huh. So I'd love to have you on again sometime. We'll talk more about the brain and some of the work you do with
neurofeedback.
Yeah. Neurofeedback and folks not being able to focus more than 5 seconds on something.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a few of these people around. I would be honored to be your guest again. And I'm thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's been great fun. A lot of great information. Now, I'll forward you the link and maybe you could put it up on your website and let folks hear you if you'd like.
Absolutely.
We'd love to have you have the link up there. Nora, thanks a lot for all your time and we'll talk to you real soon.
Sounds good, Patrick. Thank
Bye-bye.
You so much.
Nora Gidgoudis. That's fun stuff, huh? And the more I talk to her, the more this lady sounded like she really knew a thing or three or four, and we like those kind of folks at OneRadioNetwork.com. Because with each passing day, we realize here that we know less and less about the truth about diet and nutrition. So we're always just kind of looking for the truth with the idea that the cream will come to the top. And I'm getting better and better taking the less and less positions about being for or against anything. And that way I can ask better questions. And the better questions will yield the better answers. And that's just how it all works. We appreciate your kind donations because that's a way, well, a lot of our income comes from simply 5, 10, 15, 20 bucks to support our efforts, our live show every day at 10 a.m. and then again a Saturday 6 p.m. on OneRadioNetwork.com. You can donate using PayPal and a credit card, very secure, 5, 10, 20, but whatever you got, that's good. And then for those who cannot afford to donate, that's fine because, folks, it just all works. We understand. Don't worry. Just enjoy the stuff and take care of yourself and take care of your family. And you'll get to the point when you can. And then everybody else helps everybody. And it just kind of works like that. Well, tomorrow we have Open Phone Friday, one of my favorite days. We just vamp around for about 90 minutes, kind of talk about some of the people we've talked with, some of the strange things we do at home that are legal. And that's tomorrow at 10 o'clock. I love you all very much. It's an honor for me to be here with you each morning at 10 a.m. Pass on these links to everyone that you care about. I will see you tomorrow at 10 o'clock. This is Patrick Timpone. Take care.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.